today. But every year that we delay, the job becomes more difficult. Because every year you delay, you have to do that much more the next year. And if we delay a decade or two, avoiding the doubling or more will become impossible. Nate Lewis, the California Institute of Technology chemist and energy expert, uses a somewhat different set of calculations than Sokolow and Pakula, but his approach is also useful in conveying the challenge. Lewis puts it this way. In the year 2000, the world's total average rate of energy usage was roughly 13 trillion watts, 13 terawatts. That means that at any given moment, on average, the world was using about 13 trillion watts. That is what the world's electric meter would read. Even with aggressive conservation, that figure is expected to double by 2050 to around 26 trillion watts. But if we want to avoid the doubling of CO2 in the atmosphere and accommodate our own growth and that of India and China and other developing countries, we would actually have to cut global CO2 emissions by 2050 by close to 80% relative to current levels starting today. That means by 2050, we could use only about 2.6 trillion watts from carbon-emitting energy sources. But we know total demand is going to double by then to about 26 terawatts. That means, roughly speaking, said Lewis, between now and 2050, we have to conserve almost as much energy as we are currently using by becoming more energy efficient. And we also have to make almost as much clean energy as we currently use by developing non-carbon-emitting energy sources. An average nuclear power plant today produces about 1 billion watts, 1 gigawatt, of electricity at any given time. So if we tried to get all the new clean power we would need between now and 2050, almost 13 trillion watts, just from nuclear power, we would have to build 13,000 new nuclear reactors, or roughly one new reactor every day for the next 36 years, starting today. It will take all of our investment capital and intellectual capital to meet this challenge, said Lewis. Some people say it will ruin our economy and is a project which we can't afford to do. I'd say it is a project at which we simply can't afford to fail. And make no mistake, we are failing right now. For all the talk of a green revolution, said Lewis, things are not getting better. In fact, they are actually getting worse. From 1990 to 1999, global CO2 emissions increased at a rate of 1.1% per year. Then everyone started talking about Kyoto, so we buckled up our belts, got serious, and we showed them what we could do. In the years 2000 to 2006, we tripled the rate of global CO2 emission increases to an average increase for that period of over 3% a year. That'll show them that we mean business. Hey, look what we can do when we're serious. We can emit even more carbon, even faster. This is where politics meets climate, meets energy, meets technology. Do we have the political energy? Does anyone have the political energy to undertake and deploy an industrial project of this scale? Of course, being green at the rhetorical level we're at right now is not inconsistent with the broadly professed principles of either the Democratic or the Republican Party. But implementing a green revolution at speed and scale is going to mean confronting some of the economic, regional, and corporate vested interests that live at the heart of both parties, from farmers in Iowa to coal lobbies in West Virginia. Therefore, Without a real clash within the Republican and Democratic parties on this issue, there will be no real green revolution in America. When everyone, Democrats and Republicans, corporations and consumers, claims to embrace your cause, you should suspect that you have not really defined the problem or framed it as a real political question, said the Harvard philosopher Michael J. Sandel. Serious social, economic, and political change is controversial. It is bound to provoke argument and opposition. Unless you think there is a purely technological fix, meeting the energy challenge will require shared sacrifice and political will. There is no real politics without disagreement and competing interests. Politics is about hard choices, not feel-good posturing. Only when a real debate breaks out, between or within the political parties, will we be on our way to a politically serious green agenda. You can't call something a revolution when the maximum changes that are politically feasible still fall well short of the minimum needed to start making even a dent in the problem. The challenges posed by the energy climate era can't be solved at the level of current political thinking, said Hal Harvey, an energy expert at the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation. You cannot solve a problem from the same level of thinking that created it. Rob Watson, the environmental consultant, said to me one day that meeting this challenge, for real, reminded him of an experience he had in the Boy Scouts. I was overweight, and there were things I thought I could do in my head that I couldn't always do in real life, he explained. Once, my Boy Scout troop had a 50-mile hike, and to prepare, we had to do a series of training hikes. So I took hikes on my own. I thought I was going 9 to 12 miles each time to prepare, but actually I was just going 3 or 4. When I finally got out into the wilderness with my troop, I collapsed with heat stroke because I was not really in shape. I endangered myself and everyone in my group because I was not being real. I know the need to want to feel that you are doing well and doing right, but if we are not real about where we are not going to do what we need to do to survive in this wilderness. People don't seem to realize, he added, that it is not like we're on the Titanic and we have to avoid the iceberg. We've already hit the iceberg. The water is rushing in down below. But some people just don't want to leave the dance floor. Others don't want to give up on the buffet. But if we don't make the hard choices, nature will make them for us. Right now, that acute awareness of the true scale and speed of this problem remains confined largely to the expert scientific community. But soon enough, it will be blindingly obvious to everyone. Don't get me wrong. I take sucker from the number of young people being engaged by this issue. And, as the greenasathistle.com blogger rightly observed, it's better to be hypocritical than apathetic when it comes to the environment. As long as you know that's what you're doing, as long as you keep moving in the right direction, and as long as you don't prematurely declare victory. It's planting our flag prematurely that will get us in the most trouble. And that's what we've started doing lately. A green brand, some green buzz, a green concert, and we're on our way to solving the problem. Not a chance. It is as if we were climbing Mount Everest and we reached Base Camp 6, the lowest rung on the mountain climb, and decided to look around, put down our gear, pat our Sherpas on the back, and open a celebratory brandy, said Jack Hittery, the energy entrepreneur. But meanwhile, Mount Everest, all 29,000 feet of it, still looms before us. what would it actually look like from the top of Mount Everest? That is, what would a truly disruptive and transformational clean power revolution look like? Just listen. Chapter 10. The Energy Internet. When IT meets ET. Revolution is not a dinner party, not an essay, nor a painting, nor a piece of embroidery. It cannot be advanced softly, gradually, carefully, considerately, respectfully, politely, plainly, and modestly. Mao Zedong. That view from Mount Everest would look like nothing you've ever seen. Actually, being a part of it would be like nothing you've ever experienced either. It would feel like all the power systems in your home were communicating with all the information systems in your home, and that they had all merged into one big, seamless platform for using, storing, generating, and even buying and selling clean electrons. It would feel like the information technology revolution and the energy technology revolution, IT and ET, had merged into a single system. It would feel like you were living with an energy internet. I realize this may sound like science fiction or magic, but it's not. Many of the technologies that would make up an energy internet, a term used by The Economist to refer to the smart grid, already exist or are being perfected right now in garages and laboratories. What we need most now are the integrated government policies, laws and standards, taxes and credits, incentives and mandates, minimums and maximums, to guide and stimulate the marketplace to drive that innovation further, to commercialize these new ideas faster, and to bring this revolution to life sooner. This chapter is the first of four that will describe what a system of clean power, energy efficiency, and conservation would look like and how we might bring it about. This chapter will describe how an energy internet would enable you, me, and your next-door neighbor to do extraordinary things by way of saving energy and using clean power efficiently, and do them around the clock, all the time, whether or not you're thinking about it. The next two chapters will describe the integrated government policies we need to guide and stimulate our businesses and investors to commit the capital we'll need to erect such an energy internet and to invent the abundant, clean, reliable, and cheap electrons we would need to feed it. Those will be followed by a chapter on preservation, how we can also create the policies for the preservation of the natural world, the plants, animals, fish, oceans, rivers, and forests that sustain life. Taken all together, these chapters will explain what an REEFIGDCPEERPC is less than TTCOBCOG, a renewable energy ecosystem for innovating, generating, and deploying clean power, energy efficiency, resource productivity, and conservation is less than the true cost of burning coal, oil, and gas actually looks like in the real world. While many of the raw materials necessary to make this system a reality already exist in some form, it will not be easy to implement. No revolution is. But this definitely is not science fiction. So keep an open eye and an open mind, and remember what the late great science fiction writer Arthur C. Clarke famously observed. Any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic. Before we lift the curtain on this magic show, I first need to do something really mundane. I need to explain how our current electricity system in America, primarily based on a network of publicly regulated utilities, actually works. Probably the last time you stopped and thought about utilities was when you landed on one in Monopoly and had to decide whether to shell out $150 to buy the electric company. That was certainly the case for me before I started researching this book. I knew how my car worked and where the closest gasoline station was. I knew where my local water tower and pumping stations were. But I knew absolutely nothing about this thing called an electric utility, which provided the electrons that powered my life every day. I knew we got an electric bill once a month and paid it, but that's about it. Well, our power utilities are more interesting than you might think, and they are also more critical to getting the Code Green Revolution right than people realize. You may think you can skip this part. Don't. Love them or hate them, local and regional regulated electric utilities are going to remain at the heart of our nation's energy system for a long time. If we are going to build a clean energy platform, it will be largely through the actions implemented by and through America's electric utilities. They have the customer base, the ability to raise huge volumes of cheap capital, and the installed technology infrastructure that we need to drive the development of an energy internet. And the public trusts utilities. It is no accident that when people want to commit fraud, one of their favorite strategies is to knock on someone's door dressed as a service person from the local power company. Hey, come right in. So how has this utility system worked up to now? The electric utility-centric power system that exists today in the United States and most other countries was constructed according to one overarching principle, the obligation to serve load. This came about as the result of an arrangement in which local and state governments and the regulatory boards they spawned granted monopolies to power companies, utilities, to provide electricity or natural gas to customers in a certain region. In return, those utilities were obligated to do three things: to provide reasonably priced power, provide reliable power, electricity that could be counted on 24/7, 365, and provide ubiquitous power, power that would be available to every customer who wanted electricity in that utility's region of operation. This was a system that Samuel Insull, the commercial protege of Thomas Edison, crafted and sold to government agencies over 100 years ago. It provided tangible benefits to utilities, which could raise funds cheaply and efficiently to make the big power plant and transmission investments because they were guaranteed a customer base, and to customers who, for decades, got cheap, reliable, and ubiquitous power. Most publicly regulated utilities lived up to this bargain very well, powering America's growth throughout the 20th century. The utility regulators who set the rates are typically called public utilities commissions. The commissioners are usually appointed by the state governor or legislature, while regulation of interstate electronic commerce is handled from Washington by the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. But there were downsides to this largely state-by-state system. To begin with, it is often said that the American electricity grid that evolved over the years with all its power stations and transmission lines is the biggest machine man has ever made. It may or may not be. But one thing I can tell you for sure about this grid, it is the dumbest big machine man ever made, and it isn't just dumb in one way. I know I am being a bit unfair here. In terms of raw scope, the electrification of America's homes, towns, and factories, wherever they were, was truly one of the great engineering feats of the 20th century. Our economy would not be where it is today without that achievement. But while this grid was indeed ubiquitous and reliable and provided cheap power, it was not built with any intelligent design. It just emerged utility by utility, service territory by service territory, balance sheet by balance sheet, local market rules by local market rules. America, to this day, has no true national grid. It's actually a national patchwork that makes the Balkans look unified. Today, there are almost 3,200 electric utility companies in America, some of which have service territories spanning huge swaths of multiple states, while others serve just a single township or part of a county. Eventually, these electric companies and their power lines coalesced into three regional grids in America. The Eastern Interconnection, which includes the Eastern U.S. Seaboard, the Plain States, and the Eastern Canadian provinces, the Western Interconnection, which continues all the way to the Pacific, except in Texas, which has its own grid, ERCOT, the Electric Reliability Council of Texas. That's it. That's our electricity system. There is surprisingly limited integration between these regional grids and even between the individual utilities within each region. Imagine trying to drive across America from New York to Los Angeles without our interstate highway system, taking just state and local highways and using only county maps to figure out where you were going. That's what it would be like to try to send electrons from New York to Los Angeles. The fact is, you wouldn't really want to send electrons across the country because too much electricity would be lost in transmission. But this patchwork is still a problem. It is very difficult just to move electrons around within regions. Imagine trying to drive even from Phoenix to Los Angeles only on local roads, and you have an idea of what it is like to try to move electrons generated at wind farms in northern Arizona to markets in southern California. The system is also dumb in terms of pricing. Our utilities deliver electric power very reliably, but the electrons they sell are totally undifferentiated electrons. That is, in most cases, you pay the same amount for electricity that comes into your home, no matter how it is generated. Coal, oil, nuclear, hydro, wind, solar, or natural gas, and no matter what time of day it is generated, whether at peak or off-peak demand periods. You cannot differentiate. You pay one price per kilowatt hour and get one bill whenever the electric company gets around to reading the meter on the back wall of your house. There's nothing in the electric power industry today that even remotely compares to the detail of a telephone bill. Finally, the utility system is dumb in that, in most cases, there is no two-way communication between you and your utility. You, as a consumer, cannot demand, and the utility cannot provide, a specific kind of electricity generation for a specific price to a specific machine. And when the power to your house goes out, in most of the United States, you have to telephone the electric company and let them know. The utility has no other way of knowing. But God bless the grid. While it is really dumb, the electricity it has provided was, for many years, cheap and always ubiquitous and reliable. So reliable that most Americans have never even asked themselves where it came from, how it is made, or how it winds up being immediately available to flow out of the wall sockets on demand. We just expect it to be there, and when it isn't, even for 15 minutes, there is hell to pay. The state-appointed regulatory boards tell each utility operator how much it can charge for every kilowatt hour of electricity. The regulator basically instructs the utility, "You will generate cheap, reliable, ubiquitous power, we will give you a monopoly to do so, and every few years, we will determine the rate at which you can serve load in your area to ensure that your expenses are recovered and that you get a proper return on capital to run the business, provided you do your job right." Specifically, the regulator and the utility operator work out a plan, sometimes called an integrated resource plan, other times just a plain vanilla capital budget. In this plan, the utility operator tells the regulator, "Here is how I intend to serve my customers and meet my obligations to provide ubiquitous power as cheaply and reliably as I can, with this many power plants and power lines costing this much money. And once that is approved, the operator says to the regulator, I will need to recover this much money to cover all these costs. And so the regulator takes the utility's statement of its monetary needs, called a revenue requirement, chops it down a bunch, because the initial request is usually bloated, and then divides it by the kilowatt hours the utility is expected to sell. That becomes the price per kilowatt hour, which the utility then charges the consumer for electricity. That price is calculated to cover the utility's fixed cost of operating its existing power plants and the cost of investing in new plants, as well as the variable costs of the fuel that goes into generating the electricity, that is, the coal, oil, natural gas, or uranium, plus the costs of labor, taxes, and insurance, and then a cherry on top, some after-tax profit for shareholders. To put it at its most simple, utilities made their money by building stuff. More power plants and more power lines that enabled them to sell more and more electrons to more and more customers because they were rewarded by their regulators with increased rates on the basis of those capital expenditures. The more capital they deployed, the more they made. And since their new capital investments had to be justified by growth in demand, the utilities were motivated to encourage consumption, which, in turn, created the need for them to invest and build more, which, in turn, triggered the reward of increased income. The cycle became almost Pavlovian. Think about a utility, said Ralph Kavanaugh, the legendary utilities expert at the Natural Resources Defense Council, which has spurred innovation around utilities in California. Their business involves enormous sunk costs that must be recovered regardless of how much energy they sell. If they invest in a new natural gas power plant or a wind farm, it can cost hundreds of millions of dollars, even billions. And those costs do not vary if you, the customer, use more or less power. So the utility had a vital interest in boosting electricity and natural gas sales so it could be sure to recover its fixed costs. In many ways, your local utility was like a big all-you-can-eat-for-$5 buffet, explained Peter Corsell, the CEO of GridPoint, which makes an apparatus that can manage all the power systems in your home. They were paid by the regulators to provide us reliable, cheap, all-you-can-eat power. And we came to that buffet every day, and we ate whatever we wanted. And it was always open, and it was always cheap. Life was good. One reason it was cheap, though, was that the public and the regulators never asked the utilities to serve two additional things at this electron buffet. We didn't ask that the power they generated be free of CO2 emissions. We asked that traditional pollutants, particularly mercury, nitrogen oxides, and sulfur oxides emitted during the coal combustion process, be removed, which the utilities did very well, but not carbon dioxide. And we didn't encourage them to offer energy efficiency programs. We didn't encourage our utilities to reward consumers for saving energy or to enable consumers to respond to changes in supply or prices so they could buy more electricity when it was cheaper to generate and use less when it was more expensive to generate. The emphasis on cheap trumped efficiency and global warming considerations. It made sure that utilities relied as much as possible on coal plants. And for many years, if utilities could deliver electricity at a nickel a kilowatt hour, few people cared if those coal plants spewed out millions of tons of CO2, and few people cared if you used those kilowatt hours very inefficiently or in wasteful applications. In fairness, the regulators pressured the utilities to keep prices down and focus, where possible, on cheap sources like coal. The mandates for ubiquitous and reliable also worked against efficiency. Why? Because they required utilities to overbuild their supply capacity so they always had an adequate reserve margin at great cost, which was passed on to you, so they could always meet peak load demand on the very hottest days, which might occur only once or twice a summer. Adding supply was always the answer to every problem, never trying to manage demand. But then, one day, a funny thing happened on the way to the all-you-could-eat electron buffet. A few people, like Al Gore, started to wander around out back into the kitchen, and what they saw there was not pretty. And then they came back to the front of the buffet line and told the rest of us, "Do you know what is going on out back? Do you know why this all-you-can-eat electron buffet costs only $5? It's because there are all sorts of costs being incurred that are not being passed on to us customers. They are being paid by someone else." These costs were being paid by society at large or charged to our children's credit cards. In particular, the coal, natural gas, and oil that were generating all those cheap electrons for our all-you-can-eat buffets were causing global warming, childhood asthma, acid rain, deforestation, biodiversity loss, and petro-dictatorship. And no one was factoring these costs into the price per kilowatt hour you were paying. And since when something is free, or practically free, people usually demand more of it, more cheap electrons were demanded, and more destruction was occurring out back. The people running these buffets are your neighbors and mine. They're not out to harm society. They're part of it. But the dirty fuel system was set up to reliably deliver all-you-can-eat electrons at the cheapest price to every customer who wanted them, and low-cost gasoline to every driver who wanted it, even if that meant devastating our ecosystems and climate as side effects. We just didn't make all the connections until recently, and many people still haven't. Now the public consensus is shifting. Now we are beginning to understand that we need a new system, a clean energy system. We still want our electricity and fuels to be cheap, reliable, and ubiquitous, but now we also want them to come as much as possible from non-CO2-emitting sources and via a system that promotes energy efficiency and conservation, not just consumption and pollution. To be more specific, roughly 40% of America's total CO2 emissions come from the production of electricity used in homes, offices, and factories. Another 30% of American emissions come from the transportation sector, primarily cars, trucks, boats, trains, and airplanes. So if we could electrify all of our transportation fleet, save for airplanes, and make all of them, and our buildings too, vastly more energy efficient at the same time, and then supply this whole 70% buildings and transportation with clean, abundant, cheap, reliable electrons through a smarter grid, that would be a revolution. It would be a giant step toward reducing America's consumption of fossil fuels and our carbon footprint. That's the real green revolution we are seeking. But it is still too abstract for most people. So let's hop into a time machine and see what it would actually be like to live inside a real green revolution in the year 20 ECE, energy climate era. 20 ECE. Your alarm goes off at 6:37 a.m., playing the Beatles classic "Here Comes the Sun," just as you programmed it to the night before from 10,000 wake-up songs offered by your utility in collaboration with your phone company and iTunes. You have no alarm clock. The music was actually playing out of your home phone speaker, which itself is integrated into your home smart black box, or SBB, as it is called. Everyone now has an SBB, your own personal energy dashboard. Just as when you sign up for cable television, you get a set-top box or digital recorder with it, now, when you sign up for the energy internet with a progressive utility, like Duke Energy if you live in the Carolinas, or Southern California Edison if you live out west, you get an SBB. It is a microwave oven-size black box that sits in your basement and integrates the controls and assures the interoperability of all your energy, communications, and entertainment devices and services. That includes your temperature settings and other energy preferences in every room, your lighting, your home alarm system, your telephones and computers and internet connections, all your appliances, all your entertainment devices, and your plug-in hybrid electric car and its storage battery. The SBB's digital touchscreen can tell you exactly how much energy any of these devices is consuming at any moment. Your car, by the way, is no longer called a car. It is now called a RESU, R-E-S-U, or Rolling Energy Storage Unit, as in, I drive a Ford Mustang RESU. The term car is now considered so, gosh, 20th century. That is not the only thing considered old school. In the early years of the energy climate era, we progressed from an internet that connected computers and a World Wide Web that connected content and websites to an internet of things. An energy internet in which every device, from light switches to air conditioners to basement boilers to car batteries and power lines and power stations, incorporated microchips that could inform your utility either directly or through an SBB of the energy level at which it was operating, take instructions from you or your utility as to when it should operate and at what level of power, and tell your utility when it wanted to purchase or sell electricity. You and your utility now have two-way communications. Your heating and air conditioning units, your lighting, and all your appliances, your dishwasher, dryer, refrigerator, and car battery can now be programmed to run at lower levels when demand for electricity on the grid is highest and electrons are most expensive, and they can be instructed to run at fuller power during the night, or in the case of your electric car, to charge and store energy at night when electricity demand is lowest and power is cheapest. Have no fear. Signing up for this kind of system is totally voluntary. There is no big brother who will force you to do so. If you don't want to have an SBB in your house, you don't have to have one. You can still get your electricity the old-fashioned dumb way. But have no illusions. If you opt out, you will be thrown into a general customer pool and your rates will go up, because the utility will not be able to optimize the energy usage to or from or inside your home, and other customers will not be willing to pay higher rates to subsidize your wasteful and environmentally irresponsible behavior. After you read the newspaper and have your morning coffee, you call up the control panel of your SBB on your iPhone or your BlackBerry or your home computer. This colorful, easy-to-read screen will tell you how much power every device in your home is using and how much each kilowatt-hour costs at that time of day on your personal energy plan. That's right, your own personal energy plan. Your utility now offers a number of different plans, the way the phone company does, so you can program your home's energy use for lowest cost, cleanest energy, maximum efficiency, or time of day you are at home or work, among many other choices. The most popular option is the Bargain Power Nights and Weekends plan. This plan helps your utility to both balance and reduce overall energy demand By shifting electricity loads from peak hours of the day and evening, when electrons are most expensive, to off-peak hours at night when they are cheapest. Through your SBB, your utility adjusts your home thermostat up or down very slightly and instructs your water heater, refrigerator, and air conditioner to cycle off for short periods of time, so short that you don't even notice. It also allows the utility to run your dishwasher and dryer overnight, and even to turn off all your exterior lights for a few minutes at a time. In return for letting the utility manage your energy use in this way, you get a 15% reduction off your monthly electric bill. It is a great deal for the utility because it can now use its existing power plants with greater efficiency as the load peaks are being flattened and the load valleys are being raised, so it doesn't have to build new ones just for peak hours. Another popular plan is the one called Day Trading for Electrons. Under this plan, your appliances can, in effect, become your surrogate energy shoppers. You program into your SBB that you want certain of your appliances, your dryer, your dishwasher, your hot water heater, your air conditioner, to run only when electrons cost less than 5 cents a kilowatt hour, and that you want your home cooling or heating system, depending on the season, to cycle down if electricity exceeds 10 cents a kilowatt hour. You will put on a sweater or open a window instead. So you loaded the dishwasher before you went to bed, but it did not actually run until 3:36 a.m., when your SBB detected that the price of electrons had fallen to 4.9 cents a kilowatt hour. And your air conditioner cooled the house all day until about 6 o'clock p.m., when rates shot up to 12 cents a kilowatt hour, then it automatically shut itself off. It came back on at 9 p.m., when the price of electrons fell to 9.9 cents a kilowatt hour. This is a far cry from Grandpa's day, pre-1 ECE, when most utilities charged a flat rate per kilowatt hour, regardless of actual demand and cost fluctuations. In this new era, all you do is choose the day trading energy plan, and your dishwasher and air conditioner, with their smart chips inside and working with your SBB, are day trading electrons on your behalf, bidding into a real-time energy market every 5 minutes to get the best price automatically. Most consumers don't realize it, but the electricity market is an instantaneous, constantly shifting spot market in which electricity costs bounce up and down as much as tenfold in the course of a day. Your very simple monthly bill with just one rate per kilowatt hour masks this wild, gyrating electricity market going on every minute of every day, with prices changing depending on demand on your regional grid and available supplies from different coal or gas power plants, hydroelectric dams, wind farms, or nuclear facilities. For instance, when demand on your regional grid outstrips the available supply of the cheapest electrons, those generated from coal, your utility has to call on its natural gas generators, which means that the cost of electrons to the utility immediately jumps to the cost of natural gas. When demand goes down, just the opposite happens, and price might drop to the cost of cheap nuclear or hydropower. All of this was hidden in the dirty fuel system, but not anymore. Not after you installed your SBB and smart appliances, and the utility installed much more intelligent technology on its grid, so your home could read the actual electricity costs from the utility and run discretionary appliances only when electricity hit your price points. Not only are you now using power when it is most cost-effective, but thanks to steadily rising efficiency standards, you are also using less power, period. your appliances today use about one-third the electricity they needed to do the same tasks a decade ago. With the smart grid, controlling your energy usage is as simple as turning the lights on and off. Under both these plans, you just press the sleep button on the SBB control panel when you walk out the door, and all the lights and every appliance in the house will shut down or go to its lowest necessary power setting until instructed otherwise. You can call up your SBB control panel on your cell phone and tell your house to wake up the minute you land at the airport after a long trip, so by the time you get home, the hot water is available in the shower and the air conditioner has cooled down the house. Electricity is all about on-off, and the purpose of the smart grid is to make sure that whenever electricity is on, it is at its most productive. Why should all your appliances be on, sucking up what is called vampire load, when you are not home? It is because your appliances are too dumb to know better. By turning appliances on and off at the right times, the smart grid can virtually eliminate the vampire loads that can consume up to 10% of all the power in a household. Of course, when you do need to run your dryer or dishwasher at a particular time, you can just override the automatic controls, and the system will power the appliance using the cheapest power available at that moment. Your neighbor, who is a green fanatic, signed up for the Fuels from Heaven, Fuels from Hell plan. Under this plan, you pay a premium every month, and the utility agrees to cover every kilowatt hour you use with clean power from wind, solar, geothermal, or hydro, so that you are using no fuels from hell. This doesn't mean that your power is coming from clean sources for every second of every day. It means that every month, the utility has procured an amount of clean power tied to specific and actual generation sources, equivalent to the demand of all those customers on the Fuels from Heaven, Fuels from Hell plan. You can feel better about your electricity usage because you are driving the utility to constantly access more clean power sources and thereby make them more cost competitive. You and your neighbors also got together and signed up for the How Slow Can My Meter Go plan. It works like this. Where the four corners of your backyards meet, you installed four tracking solar arrays. Again, you leased them from your utility. The solar power feeds directly into each of your four homes and actually slows down your electric meters, reduces the amount of power you need to take from the grid by providing you with your own distributed power. Known as RGSUs, Regional Generation and Storage Units, the panels are maintained by your utility. Just the other day, the Duke Energy truck was out replacing two of your solar panels damaged in a hailstorm. No one had to call the company. Each panel is connected by the smart grid to Duke's supercomputer, so it could send a message immediately when a panel went down. What a contrast from the stories Grandpa used to tell about the days when a bad storm would sweep through the neighborhood and his house would lose power, but the electric company wouldn't even know until he telephoned them. What a pain that must have been, Grandpa. The utility was happy to install the solar panels, both because it is a way to earn income through new services and because you live in a densely populated area where the grid can often get stressed at peak times. So, having some customers use distributed power takes some pressure off the grid. As long as you can seamlessly and safely generate your own wind or solar power to help run your lights or heat your water, the more customers who do it, the better. Some of your relatives who live in Los Angeles have gotten even more adventurous. They got together with their utility and created their own plan, the Green Friends and Family Plan. They leased 3 parking spaces behind the elementary school down the street. Then they leased from Southern California Edison a Bloom Energy reversible fuel cell machine and connected it to their homes. It is a big black box about the size of a passenger van, and it saves money, energy, and the environment in lots of ways. It can take electrical energy from the grid late at night when power is cheapest and, via a process of electrolysis, convert water into hydrogen and store it in a storage tank and then convert it back to electricity for you and your neighbors to power homes or charge cars during peak hours when electricity is twice as expensive. It can take hydrogen or solar power and convert it into electricity, and the only waste is clean water. You can even feed it agricultural waste, and it will use a little built-in furnace to convert that waste into hydrogen and then electricity. Classes at the elementary school, which shares the electricity with the neighbors, compete over who can feed the Bloom Energy Box the most biomass and generate the most electrons. Your utility is happy to be offering these services because it's now making money from each one, rather than just selling cheap, dumb electrons at an all-you-can-eat buffet. The regulators are happy to see this because they believe these services benefit customers, help the environment, and relieve stress on the grid, so that more costly power plants are not necessary. What you don't see, but what is hugely important, is that this energy internet smart grid enables your utility to use more renewable power. As noted earlier, in the old days, utilities always built their generation systems to ensure that they could handle all the air conditioners running on the 4 hottest days of the summer when energy demand peaked. They did this in part by predicting demand and scheduling the supply a day or an hour ahead of time. They got very, very good at that. But just in case they miscalculated or ran into an unexpectedly long and intense heat wave, they also over-provisioned their grids so that, ideally, no one would be denied electricity on the hottest days. They did that by building extra power plants. It sounds smart, but it was anything but efficient. Imagine that you owned a factory that made greeting cards. If you acted like the utilities did, you would build one $10 million factory that would run at capacity every day to handle your standard business. And then you would build another $10 million factory just to handle your excess business on the week before Christmas and the 3 days before Mother's Day, Father's Day, and Valentine's Day. The rest of the year, this second factory would produce nothing, but all the machines would be on standby low power just in case there was a sudden run on birthday cards. That is a really inefficient way to use capital, but that's how we managed our utility grid for a long time. Now that the smart grid is in place, though, we can control demand. Because either the utility or the customer is able to optimize when power is used, so many more people automatically run things later at night when rates were cheapest and fewer things in the daytime when they were more expensive. The energy internet has become so smart about when you want to use power or when it would have to sell you power or when it could buy power off your car battery or home solar system that the load has become much more constant 365 days of the year. The flatter that any utility grid can make its load profile throughout the day for all its customers so that its peaks are not very high or are eliminated altogether, the fewer backup power plants it needs to build or operate. It is, in effect, substituting energy efficiency for new power generation. That is what the energy internet has made possible. But it didn't only increase energy efficiency, it has also made large-scale renewable energy practical for the first time ever. Why? Because the flatter your utility's load profile gets, the more it is able to go out and buy or generate renewable energy and sell it to you and your neighbors instead of energy powered by coal or gas. In 20 ECE, Southern California Edison now derives more than half of its power from two vast renewable energy sources, wind and solar, while using a mix of nuclear, natural gas, and carbon-sequestered coal for the rest. SoCalEd has built huge wind farms in Wyoming and Montana, and contracted with many smaller independents along the way. The Wyoming farm is so vast it is a tourist site, like the Hoover Dam, with turbines as far as the eye can see. The smart grid made all this large-scale renewable energy practical. In the old days, the big drawback of wind and solar was that they were variable. The sun was there during the day, but not at night. The wind in most parts of the country tends to blow hardest at night and early in the morning. In other words, during off-peak hours. The energy produced by these clean, renewable resources could not be cost-effectively stored using existing battery technologies. The most viable storage mechanism used by the power industry was pumped storage, using energy to pump water up a hill during the night and generating electricity via falling water during the day. The problem was that there were relatively few pumped hydro projects in this country. They were very expensive to construct, and you expended 3 units of energy moving water up the hill at night for every unit you got back the next day. Those facts made it very hard for any utility to depend on wind or solar for more than 20% of its power supply, because it had to be backed up with extra natural gas power plants for those days when the sun didn't shine or the wind didn't blow. But now that we've moved to the energy internet, the smart grid, utilities can run your refrigerator or adjust your thermostat in line with when the wind is blowing or the sun is shining. It can match the supply with the demand. Therefore, it can use more of these renewable power sources at much lower cost. When clouds block out the sun or the wind dies down, the utility's smart grid lowers demand by raising prices, so your SBB decides not to do the laundry then, or by adjusting your home temperature settings. And when the sun is shining brightly and the wind is howling, the utility runs your dryer at the lowest price. So there is now a direct correlation between how smart your grid is, how much energy efficiency it can generate, and how much renewable power it can use. Like all revolutions, though, this one changed many things at once. When the smart grid extended into a smart home all the way to a smart car, it created a whole new energy market on the other side of your electric meter. In the old days, there was no market beyond the raw, dumb electrons that came into your house. Everything stopped at the meter, and you just paid the price calculated at the end of the month. But once your appliances became smart, and a smart black box was introduced into your house, a market was also created beyond your meter and throughout your home, and, more broadly, inside every factory and business around the country. Some utilities have decided to step into that market and help you optimize your smart home to get the most cooling, heating, and other electricity services from the cleanest, fewest, cheapest electrons. Most utilities, though, have decided to serve as facilitators for this whole new industry. Energy Efficiency Service Companies, EESCs. These EESCs have emerged just like internet providers that crept up alongside the traditional phone companies to help you optimize the smart grid for your home. The utility has created this market by telling you, the consumer, that it will give you big discounts, even subsidies, for installing energy-efficient appliances or weatherizing your home to lower your consumption of electrons. This is because the government regulator has cut a new deal.